The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And I am your host, Soraya. As always, and as I've said in the past, if you're listening to this live, then it's on WVBR at 11 p.m. Eastern on Saturday night. Anything else is a rebroadcast, and obviously the live chat room doesn't work then. But if you are listening live and you have any questions for our guests, you can come into the chat and I will pass them along. And obviously we're always on live on www.wheredidtheroadgo.com the same time. So tonight, we have Scotty Roberts and John Ward returning together. How are you guys?
We're doing fine, Soraya.
Most excellent, sir.
All right. And where are you?
Well, we are seated on the deck of our Dahabeah, our Nile River boat. We are moored at the Speos of Horemheb, which is, John, you can in a second tell me what a Speos is. Horemheb was the last pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. And this site, both sides of the river, is John Ward's and Maria Nilsson's archaeological site that they're working for the next 7 weeks, their first season of the year. So, John, I'll just let John kind of describe where we are, what's going on here.
Hey, Scotty. As Scotty just said, this is Gebel El Sassila. It's the narrowest point of the entire Nile. And Gebel El Sassila actually means the mountain of chain. That refers to a chain that actually used to link between the east bank and the west bank, and it was a physical chain that was put up by the Romans to stop the boats from chartering the river so they could collect the taxes, because that's how narrow the actual Nile is here. If you were a good cricketer, you could throw a good ball from one side of the bank to the other side of the bank, but you'd have to have a throwback. But it's the largest ancient sandstone quarries in the whole of Egypt. Basically, if you know your temples and sites of Egypt, Gebel El Sassila serviced every single temple that is to the north of us in what we refer to as Lower Egypt. So the whole of Karnak, Luxor Temple, Komombo, Medina Habu, the Ramesseum, Seti, the list is endless, really. And all the sandstone came from here, the great megalithic pylons, the needles, or the obelisks, it all came from here. And as Scotty says, we're just on the deck of the Dahabeah here right now, overlooking the sun's just coming up, so we've got some morning haze around us, and we're looking at the Speos, not the Speos.
Speos.
You do love changing. Changing classical names, don't you? It's the Speos of Horemheb. And basically what that means is that it's a rock-hewn temple, a cenotaph, for want of a better word, a chamber, a small temple, a shrine, that's been carved out of the living rock. And all of the rooms, all the chambers, are literally rock-hewn. They've been carved out of the living rock. So it's not been built, it's been carved. A little bit like Petra, I suppose, but on a very smaller scale. Hmm. And that's what a Speos is. Or got me at it now. A Speos, not Speos.
That's like Cambyses.
Cambus.
He says Cambus. I say Cambyses. Egyptians say Kimbis. So
I say Speos, you say Speos.
There it is. It's called the whole thing off.
Yes.
All right.
I hope that gave you some idea of where we are. But one of the most important things, as Scotty mentioned there, Soraya, is that our season starts, well, it started yesterday, really, when we arrived. But our season starts officially today. We're going to be here now for the next 7 weeks, cataloguing, documenting, recording, photographing, everything, every single small, minute detail that we can find and discover on Silsila. As we've got the East Bank and the West Bank, respectively, it's roughly round about 10 kilometers square. In miles, I have no idea.
I don't know what a kilometer is.
I'm English, and I can't even remember what miles are anymore.
It's huge. It's a massive site.
But
it sounds.
One of the oldest parts of it, though, Soraya, is dates back to 8,000 BC. Hmm. So we've got basically when man, the Gavra hunter, emerged out of the marshlands, which is now the Western Saharan Desert, and he first emerged out of there. He came to Sicily because Sicily would have been an island in the floodwaters of the Nile. So it would have provided him with safety, shelter, an abundance of food, a water source, of course. But because the sandstone is so malleable here, he would have used it for shelter. Stacked stone, rudimentary shelters at the best, which we still have evidence of here today. And again, there's certain parts of the archaeological record that we'll be recording over the next 7 weeks. And it's a pleasure and it's an honor, and I mean this sincerely. I'm not just saying because he sat next to me, but to have Scotty with me. And, it's wonderful that we can open the site to these two non-academic people who can participate in the recording and in the archaeological work, so to speak, here at Silsila with us, to give them an idea of what it's like to live like an archaeologist, even though we're living on a Dahabir and 5-star civil service.
Just about.
But it does get, it's going to get worse, I promise you, and Scotty's going to go through that today, especially when after he's walked 20 kilometers.
Do you want to give people a little bit of your academic history?
Well, my academic history is very brief, in fact, Soraya. Basically, my as far as Egyptological archaeological work is concerned, on an academic level, that started just over, well, near enough 10 years ago. Before that, believe it or not, I was what you call an estate agent. I think that's in the States, you call them real estate agents. But my background there was in land surveying and so forth, and house surveying. And that led, I gave it all up to follow my passion, follow my dream, and that was to be an archaeologist. And I had a passion for Egyptology. And I moved to Egypt, lock, stock, and barrel. And through that, I just acquainted myself with the history, the knowledge, and so forth. And over the years, that's been built up, and I've built myself a reputation of being, through Maria, of course, here at Silsila. This is our site, and it's the passion that I have for the symbolism. That was my main source of the research, researching symbolism and its origins in Egypt and tracing its migration out of Egypt across the ancient trade routes that ran through the Western Sahara Desert, which we've retraced on foot in some cases and on 4x4 and by camel in others, as it worked its way out of northern Africa and into mainland Europe, and how that's then been assimilated into the various different cultures, religions, cults, and other mystical societies across the ages.
All right. And Scotty, is this the first archaeological site you've been on?
It's the first one that I've been actually added as part of the team. Even though I'll only be here for about a week. And so that's kind of exciting. And so I'm enjoying just being here and going to participate with them today. And I think we're going to the south today and looking at some of the old, the much more ancient sites. Hmm. And right now there's another tour boat that came by and moored here last night, and the tourists are all walking all over the rocks up there, and John's getting very sweaty and concerned. He just put his hand up and he says, "They're climbing on. There's stuff there. They can't go there."
Well, they're not meant to go there.
So, but yeah, that's what's intriguing for me, is to be able to walk around here. And there were things we walked through with our own group, with the Exodus Reality Adventures last week, where we said, you can walk through here, watch where you step. No pictures, please. There's some unpublished things here, and that's where that got left. So, but we were able to look at some pretty cool things here.
So why has this site never been looked at before?
Oh, it has, Soraya. This is one of the many people have an aversion to when we say academia. Especially within the alternative genre, they think that we're keeping the information to ourselves. It's all secret and so forth. With Silsila, It's been periodically looked at over the centuries, from Georges Lagrange, one of the greatest Egyptologists that ever lived, to Flinders Petrie, which I'm sure you've heard of. Caminos, the Argentinian Egyptologist, he spent 30 years on and off looking at Sorcilla. We also have other greats like Howard Carter came here. We actually got one of his inscriptions. He inscribed his name on one of the pillars down on Ramesses' stelae. But, you know, it's been looked at, it's been documented, but it hasn't been fully documented. It's only had snippets done. With Caminos, who was the last Egyptologist really to work here for that amount of time, unfortunately he died prematurely, and none of his work was published. Only one small article, basically a periodical, was published, which is horrendous. But we have access to most of his material now, which is kept with the EES in London. And one of our counterparts, who's joined us on the team this year, Philippe Martinez, he's actually in London as we speak, looking at that documentation and taking documentation of it, actually recording parts of it, so we can use that. But it has been left. It's not a tomb. There's no gold here. There's no treasure to be had. There's no, what's the word I'm looking for? Not splendor, but there's just no gold.
Yeah, yeah. It's not one of those sites that you're going to be awfully worried about looting and things, although it's been attempted.
It's been attempted many times.
Some of the things that are like the Ramesses spias down there. Glorious, big columns, wonderful inscriptions, painted work still existing there, even after 3,500 years exposed to the elements, and there's painted colors still on the underhang, and the lintels, and they've got what looks like, for lack of a better way to describe it, it looks like plaques of certain kinds that are framed, that are on the walls there, and they're carved out big squares, and they had inscriptions on them, and some local sheikh told somebody that there was gold in there, hidden in there, and so they start chopping away at it,
digging away,
and it's all carved out of solid stone, and so there are no chambers behind, or hidden chambers with a fake door, but it's been attempted here before, and you'll see big gaping holes and things where they've gone in about a meter and quit because there's nothing there. They're just digging stone.
You're going to see today, you're going to see it this morning. We actually have one pit that goes down to about 7 meters, Soraya, where the local sheikh told these looters that there was a golden cat buried deep within the mountain. And these guys literally hand-chiseled their way to a depth of 7 meters and then gave up. I wondered why they went...
Roughly, about 20 feet?
Yeah. I just wondered, at what point did their brain kick in and say, okay, I'm going to give up here? I mean, 7 meters. I mean, you would have given up in the first 10 inches.
Well, we've dug down into 20 feet of rock.
We haven't found it yet, but let's continue.
Let's keep going.
It's going to be there. And that's the mentality, unfortunately, because it's so enrooted that they honestly believe that the ancient Egyptians had this magical power to harness, to actually, you know, hide golden statues within the depths of the actual mountain itself. And so sometimes it's a problem for us because we're up against that, and sometimes it works in our favor because they will dig through the strata levels and reveal that and leave that for us, which actually aids our work in some way. But, you know, it is wrong, and hopefully through education and involving the local community with our archaeological site, it will aid the site itself and preserve it. We were having this discussion only last night, in fact, that we want to raise the awareness locally of Sorcilla to the local indigenous communities, which is a mixture of Egyptian and Nubians, because the Nubians were relocated here after the Nile Dam was built in 1971 when their land was flooded by Lake Nasser. So they were given a lot of land here, and some of it included Sorcilla. But it's nice to see that the local Nubian villagers actually live in harmony side by side with the ancient site itself and haven't caused any destruction.
I think too, though, that there is something that we've seen is the opposite side of that, the negative side of the respect, is it's like having grown up with something and lived there your whole life, and for generations it becomes commonplace to some people, and the importance of it disappears. And while this has been used as a quarry for thousands and thousands of years, I know John and Maria, they're running into, there are, what would you call them? There are untoward people who try to do things in the back. Everybody's greasing everybody's palms, and somebody wants this to be able to quarry it and sell the stone to build buildings and roads and things like that, with no concern for the antiquities that are here. So you've got both sides of that coin that are going on.
Yeah, and that's quite right. You said the only real damage we have done to Silsila during its history actually is the quarrying. Unfortunately, the British were horrendous. They destroyed two ancient quarries to actually quarry stone for the Esna Barrage, which was one of the second mini dams built on the Nile. And the British, when we were in charge as the colonials, we did that. We actually caused a horrendous amount of damage. But local industrial have actually taken two large chunks of Silsila through modern quarrying with dynamite. So that's caused a few problems.
Well, and there's also two ways to look at that. You can see the one side of it, saying it's antiquities, and you can't destroy that ancient past before it's cataloged and things like that. But there's the other side of that that says these are the people that have always lived here, and it's always been a quarry, and they see it as a quarry, and it's a place to get them. And so there's that fine line you have to cross and divide and protect the antiquities, while how do you keep the indigenous folks who live here from saying that's always been a quarry? I want to get some stone.
Right.
And so that's the fine line John and Maria have to walk here.
Yeah.
Well, what always fascinates me is just the power of greed, first of all. And you see these ancient sites, and everyone's always interested in treasure. And I'm never interested in the treasure aspect. Like there's the new reality show there about Oak Island. And they're trying to figure this out. And I'm thinking, well, it's a really interesting mystery. And they're all about, oh, maybe we'll find gold. I'm thinking that would be a real disappointment to me. I'm hoping you find something really interesting.
Yeah. And that's the same thing here, you know. And there's something that John pointed out when we were up at we were on the top of Serabet El Khadim in the Sinai about God, it seems like it ages ago, but it was 2 weeks ago with our people on the Exodus Reality.
I love the way you say that always. Our people.
Our people. Let my people go,
Pharaoh.
And we were at the top up there, and my daughters were along with us, and they found little bits and pieces of things. And you can, in the rubble there still, find, they found a magnificent piece of pottery, and dating back to 18th dynasty. And what do you do with that? A lot of people that are not with organized groups or don't have an archaeologist with them or an Egyptian guide, they will pick some of those things up. They can't take them home. They'll be taken away at the airport, of course, if it's antiquity. But John said one of the frustrating things for archaeologists is when people find a little bit of something, a piece of something that's out of antiquity, and they'll walk around the site and they'll carry it, and a mile later they'll just drop it back down in the dirt, and it loses its context to where it was found. And so the archaeologist has the big problem of saying, here's this wonderful piece of pottery laying here. Did it come from this spot, or did it come from a mile down where somebody picked it up and then chuffed it back in the dirt a mile later? And it messes with the archaeological process, I think, to a certain extent, and it makes it very difficult.
Then that's the problem we're going to have this morning. You've just seen that tour group now. There's about 20 people. Now, they've gone off the path. For what reason, I have no idea. But they've decided to go off the path. They've climbed the mountain. Now, they're going to climb across the archaeological material that we've got a survey and document today. So, Scotty, you are firsthand going to be frustrated by the fact that you've got footprints everywhere to take photographs, but you've also got disturbed material. So you're not going to know whether that pot... And you're going to see broken pieces of pottery because they've trodden on them. You know, the archaeological record isn't an infinite amount of material. Once it's broken, it's broken.
Right. And you'll see, like John mentioned, even Howard Carter, who... was the man who discovered King Tut's tomb, famous for that. on the pylon of the stele of Ramses over on the east bank, he carved his name in it. And so some of that is a piece of history all by itself. You can say this famous archaeologist from 100 years ago carved his name in this stone. The problem with that is that people still want to do that today. And so where do you draw the line and say graffiti is graffiti and modern graffiti starts to become defacement?
Yeah.
That's a tough part, because we were at Menedat Habu, and you see all over that temple, you see where Napoleon's armies all scratched their names in it, and their regiments scratched their names in it, things like that. It's a piece of history. But if a modern army today was to go in there, we'd stop them and say that's defacement.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine an American or a British contingent in Afghanistan, or here, for instance, so let's put into context, and they started scrawling their names with their banner ends all over the walls of the Speos here, there would be public outcry back home.
Right. So,
you know, it's very difficult.
Yeah, where's the cutoff?
Yeah, where do you draw that line? Where's the underlining part on that? So it causes us a problem in many respects, but in other respects, it's a piece of history which needs to be recorded and for posterity.
So if you could imagine the most incredible thing you could find during this dig, what would it be?
Oh, God, you put me on the spot.
You know what? You know who's wandered onto deck is Dr. Maria Nilsson. This is her site. Maria.
Boss.
Come over here for just a second. Here's an impromptu guest for you. She is in charge of this site, and I would say she is one of the outstanding things about Maria is she is the only Swedish woman to have an archaeological site and the only woman to have her own site in Egypt.
Hmm. Well, the only Swedish woman, at least.
The only Swedish woman. There you go. This is Dr. Maria Nilsson. What would you say at this site would be the most spectacular thing that you could come across?
Well, since we cover so many sites and so many periods, it's a wide range, really. But personally, I would say an early form of Egyptian script, something that belongs with the pre-dynastic that we're studying at the moment. Also to find something that help us date our 8,500-year rock art. Things like that are beyond what we are used to finding. That would be wonderful.
That's for you.
For me.
I want to find a road.
We got many roads.
No, but I want to find a road with a sledge, with hammers and chisels, mallets, the actual moving equipment that they use to move the blocks themselves. Some nice rope. I'd like to find some rope.
Oh, you know, we were walking up there the other day. I get a chance to look at it, but I was told by John, this is an old road. And you look at it and you say, I don't see road here. But he pointed out the delineating features, you know, the laid rock to create a road. And it's all rubble in there now, but there apparently are inscriptions.
You're going to see them today.
Inscriptions saying this is the road.
This is the road built by such and such a general in such and such a year of such and such a pharaoh in such and such a dynasty. And we've got them all over this site, which is wonderful, Sarai. I mean, Sicilia is it's like a window into the and when I say quarrying techniques, I don't mean that to sound quite boring, you know, quarrying stone, you know, it's not a temple, you know, it's a quarry. Let's get that first and foremost. But the archaeological material that's sitting here and that's buried as well will give us insights. I mean, one of the biggest quandaries, one of the biggest questions when you talk about Egypt is, how did they build the pyramids? Oh, I have no idea how they moved those huge megalithic blocks of stone. How did man just chisel that with a chisel and a hammer? How did he do it? How did he move it? Well, hopefully we'll have the answers here, even although in much smaller block form. But, you know, the blocks here are still 2 meters by 1 meter wide.
It was aliens.
It wasn't aliens. It was levitation.
You know, we make light of that. And I've written about some of those things before. And your audience is going to be somewhat familiar with that side of the conversation and some of the monuments and the megalithic structures around the world.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I'm impressed with, and John and I both say, and John is an academic, Marie is an academic, you can't dismiss anything. You can't say that did not happen. But as John is very fond of saying, we weren't there and we don't know. But what John and Marie are looking here for here specifically is man's touch. What did man do? And it's very obvious by looking at things such as, it sounds so mundane, but you see chisel marks. They can determine by chisel marks and varied kinds of chisel marks what kinds of tools were used here and what they did to actually do this. There's evidence all over of how ancient man quarried these huge stones, dragged them out of the quarries, put them on boats, and sailed them up or down the Nile. And I like to say, as intriguing as the ancient alien question can be, which I think probably exists in man's past to some certain extent. It's a big universe. The evidence here is that ancient man, you cannot dismiss the ingenuity of humanity. You cannot dismiss the ability to have 20,000 people working for you on a task. John set up a scenario with our group showing how this whole row here, you can see the rows where stones were removed, how it took one guy chiseling, another guy behind him taking away baskets of debris, another guy walking the debris down, another row below them doing the same thing. And he said, if you had 90 people working this here, you could have 90 stones in 2 hours. And pulled out of there roughly, I'm giving the hypothetical here. And that's how this quarry worked. And it's interesting to see the touch of humanity on everything here.
What I find interesting is I've had so many guests who have talked about ancient mysteries and lost civilizations and stuff, but I don't think any of them have actually supported the ancient alien idea, including a number of them who are on Ancient Aliens, like Robert Schock and Andrew Collins and Brian Forrester. None of them have really pushed the ancient alien idea. They all kind of seem to think it was man-made to some degree in some way, shape, or form.
Well, I was on Ancient Aliens, too, several times. Mm. And I continue to say, even on that show, it seems to me that we have to, if we're going to say it was that kind of an ancient alien or paleo contact kind of a touch to things, you're degrading the ingenuity of humanity, of human beings, to have done what they did. I, for one, don't have any problem saying there may have been paleo contact of some kind. Do I believe they were responsible for mankind quarrying stone and building megalithic structures? Absolutely not, because everywhere we've been, I remember we were up inside the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid a year ago, John and I, and I looked around as we were going up the Grand Gallery inside the pyramid, and I said, one thing is very obvious to me. This place was built by guys, and it's the marks are all over. There's nothing special about it other than they are huge structures that they had the time, the manpower, even at Giza Plateau. They've uncovered in recent years the workers' village there.
Right.
There's an entire city built around the Giza Plateau, the Sphinx, the pyramids, where these people lived for generations building these things, and that is what they did. And so, very unique stuff.
All right, we got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be right back with Scotty Roberts and John Ward.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we are talking with Scotty Roberts and John Ward tonight on the show. And so, to continue where we just left off, what do you guys think of the possibility of a lost Ice Age civilization that may have been a legacy before Egypt and such?
Do you know, can I take it away. This is just one thing. My father, I remember him saying this many times as a child, he was actually an advocate of that. He actually believed that there was an entire civilization, a lost civilization, hidden beneath the ice of Antarctica. Hmm. And he always told me that. It always stuck with me. Personally, maybe.
Isn't that a Bulwer Lytton thing?
It is a Bulwer Lytton. Vril.
Bulwer Lytton, British writer, I guess you'd say. He was in the 1870s, wrote what could possibly be categorized as the first science fiction novel. And we've seen old movies based on his idea where the two explorers stumble across a subterranean culture, mm-hmm. Like an Atlantis. And their power was this this amazing substance called Vril. And it was very interesting that even up into the Nazi era,
so far, yeah.
Adolf Hitler sent teams out to the Antarctica looking for the source of Vril, because they didn't think Bulwer Lytton was writing fiction. They thought he was writing something about a culture and a civilization that actually existed.
They thought he was an enlightened soul, along with Madame Blavatsky.
Yeah, and the Theosophists.
Yeah.
So, very interesting.
But it, the climate differentiation is very interesting one, Sarai, because, I mean, that, again, not that I want to harp on about Scylla, but we have the evidence of that here. We can see where man came out of the marshlands, which is now the Western Saharan Desert, and basically built himself a home here. On the mountaintop of Scylla, as I said before, when the Nile rose and it became flooded, the plains around became literally lakes of water, and the two points, both on the east bank and the west bank, became islands, while the rest of the land around it became submerged. So one can easily see how the climate change has changed also the domestication of the area itself, and how the indigenous inhabitants have adapted the environment to the locale. It was only up until the late 70s that people actually started living here, because before that, the Nile still rose and the land was still flooded, so it was inhabitable up until that point. So the three villages that we have that surround us here now did not exist up until the 70s. So it is interesting when we start to see how we control and manipulate our own environment along with Mother Nature as well.
Hmm. Okay.
So I wouldn't discount some kind of evidence of a civilization of some kind lying beneath the vastness of the ice sheets of Antarctica. I wouldn't want to dismiss that at all.
Okay. All right. How do you think that a site like Göbekli Tepe figures into what's happened in Egypt over the centuries?
That's another question, but there are linkages. Again, you're looking at a site that dates back to 12,000 years from now, which, if you remember, and this is old news, of course, we used to think the oldest civilization on Earth was the Sumerian culture, dating back into the 4800s BC. Now, Göbekli Tepe is another 4,000 to 6,000 years older than that. And there are sites. Weren't you mentioning to me the other day
we were
a site that's even older than
when we were at the Göbekli Tepe? I was going to say, but now when we were at the Nubian Museum, the Nubian Museum has got a wonderful collection of standing stone.
it's
just stone that stands.
It's something that Zai Hawass, because it had stood out in the middle of nowhere.
It had been endangered by tourism with 4x4s.
Here you've got standing. A mini version of Stonehenge. These are smaller stones, 2 and 3 and 4 feet tall, that were marking what they thought might have been a calendar or something. But the interesting thing is that here it is standing in the middle of nowhere, and somebody ran over it with a 4x4 and damaged it. And so Zai Hawass,
he moved it all.
He moved the whole thing, lock, stock, and barrel, to the Nubian Museum in Aswan.
Yes.
And so it stands there outside the museum, and you can go even walk through it if you wanted to. It's just standing outside. It's got a small wall around it off the path, and if you wanted to get off the path and go walk in it, you could. But that dates to when?
Yeah, I mean, that's about 30,000 years old.
Really?
30,000 years.
I mean, you're talking about the inhabitants of northern Africa then. which, I mean, it's nowhere near as intricate, intricate as Göbekli Tepe. But it does show you that, you know, man's ingenuity at harnessing his own environment has stood the test of time. The relationship between Göbekli Tepe and Egypt, though, there is a gaping hole there, Soraya, and there is a gaping hole there, and the archaeological community are aware of this, and it's something that needs to be plugged. Hopefully, with further excavations in Turkey at Göbekli Tepe, we'll unveil either a crossover, either diplomatically and so forth, and there'll be materials, archaeological materials found there that will show a kind of relationship between its neighbors and so forth. Until that happens, and as one saying always say, you know, as long as archaeologists keep their trowels in the ground, history will be forever changing. And I think that is, there's never more the case than Göbekli Tepe. That has really changed the history books for us, and it will continue to do so as they continue digging there.
And you know, you go into a little more of the fanciful side of this, and some of the things that people like to look at, they like to look at the lost civilizations, they like to look at biblical archaeology. One of the things in that same region, basic region as Göbekli Tepe, is there's always been this quest to find Eden. And they say that some of the research you do, if you look at the biblical map, if you will, it kind of lays out, you know, it lay between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers with the Gishon River running this way and that, and it was in this little square area. You can, even though river flows have changed and the landscape has changed due to, you know, the Ice Age and things like that, you can still pinpoint where this region was. And if you say that Eden, or the cradle of civilization in the Fertile Crescent, lay in that Edenic area there, which is now in the north of Iraq, up toward the Turkish border. You've got Göbekli Tepe is just a stone's throw away from there. And so you're looking at some amazing sites up there. But then you come down to Africa and find something that's 30,000 years old, you know, which is another 18,000 years old.
But then again, you could take, I mean, staying on topic, but being a little bit fanciful, sure, about this. When we were doing the research for Moses, we were finding within the historical record here in Egypt certain historical points that pointed or were direct correlations to the biblical Exodus.
Yes.
Yes or no?
Yes. Yeah.
With Göbekli Tepe, being given its age, would it not be something that could be referred to as Eden?
It could be.
You know,
this may have been an Edenic culture.
Yeah.
It then puts a twist on your biblical stories when you find out there was civilization that's even much older than that region.
Yeah.
And mankind's existence there, or evidence of his existence there. So it starts to beg the question if the biblical record is a retelling of something with that spiritual faith-based twist to it. That was that religion's culture, because you find other cultures and other places that are much older. So that to me has been very interesting, very eye-opening. As my former training was as a seminarian, biblical studies, and so on earlier in life, and I've drifted from that mostly because of things that I find in evidence that say there's a biblical story. But when you start looking into the historical reference, like we did with our book, Exodus Reality, you start finding evidence that gives a little different twist to the story. And you start looking at the real story beneath the story, and you find some things that are very interesting. You find correlations, seeming correlations to things that took place in the Exodus story. Things such as... There is in the Hebrew writings the fact that the tribe of Dan diverted from Moses and the rest of the Israelites after the Exodus, and they went north. And you can find evidences of the Danoi in the Aegean Sea up in the Grecian area. And they have pictorial records that are thousands of years old that show boats coming from northern Egypt, and then the Nile River is in there, and they settle there. The Danoi, linking to the tribe of Dan. You've got the Danoi inscriptions over in the north of Israel and things like that, a harbor port. And the Danoi were said to have mingled with the remnants of the Anunnaki peoples. up in northern Mesopotamia, and where you've got the Anunnaki. They became known in some of the legends as the like in the Celtic legends, the Tuatha De Danann, or the Tuatha De Anu. They were all from the Anunnaki, the blending, they said, of these tribes, of the tribe of Dan, the children of the goddess Danu, they became, and things like that. So you start looking at all these historical references, and you get a very different picture of just the basic faith-based story that you find in biblical accounts, which is why so many people are so intrigued by biblical archaeology. Biblical archaeology doesn't necessarily mean that you're out trying to establish that the faith stories in the Bible are true, but that you are looking for the evidences of the stories found in the Bible to find out what the real story might be behind it. And you might come close, both John and I in our book, Exodus Reality, we come very close to the biblical story, but, you know, like John's version shows Moses as an archetype, I show Moses as somebody who was somebody in Egypt and became Moses. And so, the record is scant, but it's there. And that's what so intrigues me about archaeology. And I think what intrigues John about archaeology in many different facets is this establishing why certain things are so. Why do you find certain symbols on the lintel of the church at Garway in England? And why do you find those same symbols here in the quarries of Gebel El Silsila? Things like that. And so it's all intriguing when you start looking at the bigger picture. Step out of the box and look at the bigger whole.
There are, obviously, I'm sure you've heard different rumors about Egyptians having made it to the U.S. in ancient times. Do you think that's a possibility?
That's a Scott Walter show.
Scott Walter obviously covers it, but it's not like it started with him.
I don't think it's far-fetched.
I don't. You know what? It's not far-fetched. The only problem we've got with that, Sarai, is that we don't have any boats within the Egyptian archaeological record that have keels. Most of them are flat-bottom boats because they were Nile,
right.
Basically Nile navigational vessels, so they didn't require a keel. Unless we found archaeological evidence of the Egyptian fleet that sailed the Mediterranean, then and only then can we start to really look at strong evidence for a vessel that could navigate the not only the Mediterranean but then of course the Atlantic to get across to the continental United States. That is one thing. Another one would be we would need a boat also that could navigate the Red Sea all the way down to the Horn of Africa and then around. So the two routes that they could possibly have taken, we would need a vessel that was basically seaworthy enough to make that journey. And unfortunately, we don't have that archaeological record as yet. Again, I stress, as yet, because we're forever finding remnants all over the place. And it was only in September of last year that the cave was found, a rock-hewn cave in the coral mass off the Red Sea, where inside it laid millions of fragments of papyri and strands of rope all curled, all coiled up, nicely, neatly tucked away in the corner, beams of wood that was ready carved and so forth, all for shipbuilding. But the papyri and these fragments are literally in their millions, and it's going to take at least 50 years to put them all back together again. But some of them that are readable have been translated immediately, and they pertain to Khufu, the great pyramid builder of the Great Pyramid itself. And it actually mentions the Great Pyramid within the papyri fragments itself. But again, it gives us direct evidence that Khufu, or the pharaoh of the time, there were boats that were able to navigate the Red Sea that would have required a keel. So again, it's not out of the realms of possibility. It is a possibility. I don't think we should dismiss it out of hand. And this is where I come in, Sarai. This is where I'm kind of different to the normal academic, I suppose, because I never dismiss anything. I always, if I don't have the evidence for it, if I don't have the archaeological record to support it, I won't dismiss it. I just shelve it. until such time that I come across evidence, I have through research and so forth, that can support it in some way, and then I can look at it again from a different angle. And I think, you know, having the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, navigate the Mediterranean, navigate the Atlantic, and then land on the shores of America, it's not far-fetched, but we can't say yes because we don't have the evidence for it. We can just hypothesize about it, you know, theorize and wait until we've got something that within the archaeological record that really substantiates it and supports it.
All right. And Scotty, you brought up the Anunnaki, and I think most people, when they hear that word, immediately start thinking of Zechariah Sitchin and his ancient alien theories and such. For both of you, I guess, what is your opinion on who were the Anunnaki and the Nephilim, for that matter?
Well, the Anunnaki, there's much ado about the Anunnaki. And if you start looking at the cuneiform tablets, which I've done, and by the way, if you ever want to sit down with your wife, or I don't know if you're married, your wife or your girlfriend or your significant other, and have a fantastic read at 3 a.m, which I did to my wife once. I was reading through a book which was modern translations of the ancient Mesopotamian cuneiform tablets. I mean, exciting reading. And
yes, because we always take that book to bed with us to woo our women.
Yes, we do.
Well done, Scotty. I can see why you have such
candlelight, children. A little incense, a bubble bath, and ancient cuneiform texts.
Wow,
to read.
You really know what to look after, right?
Honey, let me regale you. But I remember one night, it had to be about 2:30, 2:45 a.m, and I'm reading in this book, and my wife had drifted off. We had the TV going, and I said, Rainey, wake up, are you awake? She said, well, I am now, you know, of course, that line. And I said, you've got to hear this. And as she sat up with her chin, you know, on her elbow with her chin in her hand, she goes, go ahead. And she's so used to it. And what's amazing is you start reading these texts and you see lots of things start to emerge. First of all, a kind of biblical speak, the kind of thing that you would read in the Bible, worded the same way in some of these old texts. But when you start reading about the Anunnaki, Sitchin put a whole lot of ado to them. And again, you can't dismiss everything offhand. He may have been onto something. But the one thing about Sitchin that I have learned over the years is that while he had his theory going and he stuck to it like any academic, they get their theory and you try to change their mind. It's like pulling teeth. But he mistranslated so many things, mm-hmm. and sometimes you had to ask the question, did he do this deliberately after a while? Because there are things he overtly had to have ignored in order to get his theories. It's very simple thing when you're talking about the Anunnaki. In one place, he references them as the people of the fiery rockets. Mm-hmm. Now, he pulls that from the Sumerian word mu. It's spelled in English, M-U. And mu is where he gets his word for the fiery rockets. The only problem with that is mu. There was an ancient lexicon left behind by the ancients that has like a dictionary of their words in several different languages of the region. And mu means the conical, spherical shape of the heavens above. And so there's nothing about fiery, there's nothing about rockets. But what Sitchin did is he said, this cone shape must refer to the cone shape of a rocket. And now, remember, in the day and age he was writing this, you know, technology was a little different than it is now. And so he ascribed that to mean, or translated that to mean, the people from the fiery rockets, when all it really meant, the word mu, was referring to the firmament, the heavens above us, the conical shape of the sky where the rain comes from and the stars shine at night. And so he made an exponential stretch in his, and that's just one example of the linguistic stretches he made.
Right.
And so you start to look at that and you say, were the Anunnaki anything other than something like the Greeks and their pantheon of gods with Zeus and Apollo? Some of that's Roman. The Romans took the same thing. The Anunnaki were merely the pantheon of gods of the ancient Sumerian people. Whether they were real people or real kings that were deified is still under a lot of debate. But the Anunnaki, and there's, of course, the linkages to the Nephilim and all that because of the biblical story, which talks about the sons of God, the B'nai HaElohim in the Hebrew, came down and intermingled with the daughters of men.
I feel so wooed when you put that accent on. Do you want to say it again? Say it again.
John, look into my eyes.
b'nei ha'elohim.
Oh, baby. Oh, now, you know how to woo
now,
me.
Now let me light a candle and read you some cuneiform.
Woohoo! We're in tonight.
So you start looking at that and the comparative stories between the two, and you wonder if they're one and the same. One of the things I noticed about my research with Moses, as a man, would have been somebody who was thoroughly Egyptian by the time he left Egypt. He was, if he is either of our characters in our book, our theories, he was somebody who was a grand vizier. He was someone who's very close to the throne, a hereditary crown prince. John's character, Amenhotep, son of Hapu, was deified. During his lifetime, the people deified him. And so you look at these characters, they were very important people that were also very much into the mysticisms, if you will, and the magics of Egypt. Moses, if he existed as we see him in the Bible, was a man who experienced this. You don't think of the Moses of the Bible being this, but he was a man who was associated with and practicing the ancient magics and mysticism, hermeticism of Egypt. And this is what he was, you know, if you fast forward to the burning bush experience, this is what he was. He had his epiphany, and he was the only one there. This is the first time he had Jehovah worship came into the picture for him, was when he was 80 years old, according to the biblical text. But then you see the things he did afterwards. He is a man who incorporated Egyptian religion and forms of government, Sumerian, Sinaitic culture, all put into developing Judaism. So in a sense, he built Judaism out of whole cloth, but he incorporated stories of the Anunnaki, of the Mesopotamian gods, Elil, the chief of the Anunnaki, Enki, known as Ea in the neighboring Akkadian cultures. These two gods' names, 1,500 years later, when Moses is writing about them, changes the name. Elil becomes El, or El Shaddai, El Elyon, Elohim. Enki, Ea, becomes the base word for Yah, is Yahweh, or Jehovah. And you start seeing all these references that start to match each other in ancient culture. And what it starts to look like is that when Moses created Judaism, he created a new religion based on all the things he already knew out of whole cloth and incorporated all of those practices in. And when I write about Moses in the book of Nephilim, I entitle the chapter The Pharaoh God of Israel, because I think what he brought to the table were things where, and you see it all through the Old Testament text that he wrote, he keeps building himself as the Pharaoh God without using those terms. He was a man who was more than a man. He was the man who in one chapter could talk to God face to face as a man talks to his friend. Yet, 9 verses later writes, and no man can see God's face and live. He's establishing that I'm more than a man. He's a Pharaoh God. And so you start talking about the Anunnaki and the Nephilim. The Nephilim is sourced in the book of Genesis, which Moses wrote by tradition. And where did he get his information? From the Anunnaki, from the Egyptian culture, the Ogdoad and the story of creation in Egypt, from the Anunnaki and their story of creation in that Edenic place. Eden comes from the Anunnaki story, where Enki rises out of the great underwater world sea, the Abzu, and comes to the aid of the humans to help free them from the bondage to the gods, Elil. And Enki is one of the gods who gives the forbidden knowledge to the humans to rebel. And he comes out of a place known as the Serpent's Marsh, which was also known by his name as Ea's Den, which became known as Ea-Den, or Eden, finally, in the Genesis account. And so all of these things start to become very linked, and you have to ask yourself the question, what came first, the chicken or the egg here? Was it Moses writing about the Genesis story, or did he borrow that information from a much more ancient culture, which, if you are a person of faith, can put you in a quandary? And which is what it did to me a few years ago. I remember I sat and I was a person of faith, Christian faith, and I had to scratch my head and look at the ceiling. I remember even saying to God, I said, all right, God, what is it? Is it Genesis or is it Anunnaki? Is it Egyptian culture? What came first? And it's obvious that the Genesis and Exodus stories all came much longer after other established religions, which had nothing to do with Judaism, but were simply the same story. And so there's the big question, Soraya.
All right. Okay.
Just led us down a path of confusion there. But there you
you're on WVBR FM Ithaca. This is Where Did the Road Go? We're going to spend a few more minutes here with Scotty and John Ward. Now, the way you describe the place you're at now, could this be something that could have been Zep Tepe, the area the first time?
No.
No? Okay.
That would be stretching it.
Because the way you described it as like an island rising out of the Nile and such.
Yes, I mean it has all the indicative components that you would attribute to that. But I have to put my hand on my heart and say no, it's not. Because I don't have the archaeological record to support that at the moment, Soraya. But who's to say that we won't find that in the next 10... I mean, we're going to be here for the next 40-plus years anyway, if I'm still alive. Maria looks over me and thinks, oh, my God. But, you know, if we ever come across it, then yes, that would change history. But at this present moment, no. It isn't indicative of that. Okay. What it's indicative of is that it's I always like to use, and I'm going to refer back now to my old real estate agent days, location, location, location. When a location is good, it will always be good as long as the environment in which it stands is coherent with it. And here at Silsila, we have got a location, location, location. It is perfect for habitation. It is perfect as a source of shelter, a source of food, and a source of water. And those three main things is what mankind requires to sustain his living and that of his family and his external family, so to speak, a tribe. And Silsila provides that and had provided it. At some point in its history, it fell dead. And man didn't live here. He didn't turn it into his home. It was a place where he would come to during the seasonal floods. But he didn't desire to actually build a main home here and stay here and turn it into a city or that kind of that ilk. It provided one other great source, and that is its stone. And that's what it became known for, and that's what it's famous for, and that's what it was known for through the ancient period. Its stone was used for all of those other paths.
Okay, all right. So you guys just finished your Exodus tour.
Yes.
And in doing all this, have you learned anything new about your theories, or have your minds changed at all on any of your theories since you've published the book?
I do have to bring this. John, just as everything is always Amenhotep, son of Habu. what we found, there was something that for all the times John and Maria have been to Menidat Habu, Daryl Medina, that temple, it was Maria who pointed out on the inside wall of the gate,
please,
the picture of Amenhotep, son of Habu.
And, well, I believe it is, anyway.
John had never seen that there before, but this was his temple, was it not?
It was, indeed.
And here's a picture of a man. You see his feet. He's got a staff. He's got a, you know,
Didn't it have a snake wrapped around it?
Something that John says. John imagined that there was a snake wrapped
and
around it.
And didn't it have underneath it millions of little people?
The important point here, though, is that this is something, when you talk about new discoveries, that's not a new discovery, but it's something new that's been seen and identified by John and said, hey, wait a minute, that ties again into my theory, establishing the presence of this man. Doesn't say anything about Moses, but it says this man is here. And so what's interesting, I think, about that from my perspective, at least watching how John and Maria work, you can have established theories, and as John just said, every day you put a trowel in the ground, you could stir up a new discovery. There's always another apple to add to the cart. So you may have an established theory that exists on something, even an established, beyond a theory, what'd you call it, an established fact. And you could overturn something, you could dig into something and find something that absolutely overturns that established fact. That's what I think is fascinating about what they're doing here at Silsila. It's part of that process.
Okay, all right. So earlier, John, you mentioned Zahid Hawass, and how has the culture there changed archaeology-wise since he's left, like for good and bad?
Yeah. Do you want me to really comment on that?
Yes, yes, I do.
It's
we got a great wind just swept through.
Wind just swept through.
Whatever they have,
everything everywhere. Yes, I mean, it has been good and bad. There are his followers, of course, that were upset at his demise and his leaving. There were those who supported him who were also equally upset by his leaving. One of the main problems we've seen, of course, here in Egypt, but one has to put this in context. It goes hand in hand with the revolution that's happened in Egypt since 2011. The country is in political turmoil, and through political turmoil, there has been instability within within Egypt itself. And through that lawlessness, through that, we've had increased looting and so forth throughout the ancient sites of Egypt. And that has really brought to home how not powerful, not strong, but how Zawi really did yield his fist across the ancient sites of Egypt. He brought everything together. And with his leaving, there is a void, but I've got to stress this. That void is also part and parcel of the revolution in Egypt and the political unrest. And we are seeing right now Egypt emerging out of that period of turmoil and, for want of a better word, disaster, because that's basically what did happen in 2011 with the uprising of Mubarak. But hopefully within the next couple of years, we'll see stability come back to Egypt. And as we've said at the very beginning, as you said yourself, Sarai, you know, we've just finished our Exodus Reality Adventure Tour, where we took a group of 10 people across across Egypt, right from the Sinai Desert, all the way through Cairo, all the way down through Luxor, all the way down through Upper and Lower Egypt, down through Aswan, all the way right down to the Sudanese border, where we viewed the sun rising at Abbas Simbel, where it illuminated the inner chamber of the Abbas Simbel temple itself, to mark the birthday of Ramesses II.
And then, by the way, just on that point, there were 10,000, according to the news, 10,000 people. We stood in a crowd pre-dawn to watch the sunrise on Ramesses' birthday hit the inner chamber of his inner sanctum of his temple there at Abu Simbel. We were surrounded by 10,000 happy, friendly, wonderful, cheering, dancing Egyptians coming out to see him. And our Egyptian guide was elated at this. He said it brought tears to his eyes to say, I see my own people happy about their history. And there were 10,000 people there dancing and watching the sunrise to see this. And we're in the midst of all of this. And you can even see some of the pictures of that over at our Facebook page for Exodus Reality Adventures. But just an amazing sight to see.
It was. One thing it proved is that the Egyptians do have respect for their history. Do acknowledge it. It's not all about the looting, and it's not all about stealing the gold and the treasure and selling on the antiquity market. You know, we've said this time and time and time again, Sarai, that the Western media paints and portrays a totally distorted picture of Egypt. And never was truer a moment when we stood amongst the throng of people at Abbas Simbel. And that just proved that there is a complete disparity between what the media reports in the West to what is actually happening here on the ground in Egypt. And, you know, Egypt is a safe country. It has its problems. Hell, so did London during the days of the IRA.
I can go to Chicago and get knifed if I'm on the wrong street. You know, and John grew up in England in the 70s. And saw the IRA bombings, and people weren't saying, oh, it's not, England is not a safe country. Yeah, there's things that happen here, sure. There's isolated things. We drove through Tahrir Square with our group in our bus. This is the center of all the news stories you see, the little round, there's a paradox, the round square of the government center and all the government activity where there's been unrest. And it was all full of traffic and cars and people walking to businesses and shops open everywhere. And I took pictures in Tahrir Square. It's a normal place. And so the safety in Egypt, by the way, which John just brought up, is an important point. We have this tour we just took. And some people they still came, but they were a little nervous. What do we expect in Egypt? And Chris Conway, who came along with us, our medium,
he came along from Scotland, and everybody was telling him, "Don't go to Egypt," you know. And he was a little intrepidatious when he came.
Yeah.
But he just wrote a beautiful blog on the safety in Egypt. We were in the Sinai of all places, in the Sinai wilderness, as the Bible calls it. And we climbed the mountain Serabit El Khadim, which is what John and I both based even on Flinders Petrie, who believed this was the mountain of God in the book of Exodus, the Mount Sinai. And we were there, and it was the most peaceful, tranquil place you'd want to be. And
yet the West portrays it as a place that's full of terrorists running around and, you know, around the mountaintops. And yet we didn't meet anybody.
We didn't meet anybody. And we were the guests of the local sheikh there, Sheikh Salim Barakat. Put us all up in his Bedouin tents and served us a sumptuous feast one night. And his family, the mountain is on their land, so to speak. And it's been there for generations. His family have been the sheikhdom, if that's a right term to use.
The sheikhdom.
Of that region. And what's interesting about all of this is that you started off with Zahi Hawass. I think he still has some influence here.
Hmm.
He's not in an official office here, but he is the man, I think, that really put the protections on these sites. And he was probably the best PR for Egypt. I would say, whatever anybody's opinion is about Zahi Hawass, he's a man who loves his country and loves his heritage.
Yes.
And he protected it. And that has been removed to some extent with his not being in power here. But I think that's all going to change.
But that, as I say, that does go hand in hand with the turmoil. And we've got an amazing minister at the moment, Mohammed Ibrahim Ismail, who's fantastic minister for antiquities. And we're seeing some major changes at this present moment, and all for the good. And hopefully it will continue.
All right. Are you doing another Exodus reality tour?
We are indeed.
We are indeed. It's already been... As a matter of fact, if people are interested in this, I would highly, highly recommend, not a sales pitch, but if they're interested in coming on this tour, they should act fast, because we've got a lot of interest in it. And it's October 13th through the 25th of this year. We're going to take 10 more people out here, and we've got a lot of interest stirred up as a result of this trip. So if anybody is interested in coming along with us, what's unique about Exodus Reality Adventures to tour groups, it's not your typical tour group in Egypt. It's we had no less than 6 or 7, was it? Egyptologists who are Egyptian,
yeah.
Maria Nelson being one of them, who's an archaeologist, that were our guides at different sites throughout. And they were all have been officials within the Department of Antiquities at one time or in one form or another or presently. All of these guys were there, and they're friends of John's and Maria's. And these are people, because of John's and Maria's connections, we have access to these government people that can get us in to see things you normally can't get to see, that have information. So we didn't just go and walk into a temple and, oh, snap, 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 click, 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 take a picture of this pretty inscription. We had Tayeb, our Egyptian Egyptologist, who came along with us for the whole 2 weeks, would sit and decipher and translate the inscriptions in hieroglyph. And he would point out, he would teach hieroglyphics as we were there and say, this is why this is important, and this is what this means, and this is why this is here. And it made this trip fascinating.
It gave a whole different interpretation. I mean, instead of people coming who have a certain amount of knowledge of the ancient sites and so forth, we were able to utilize, as Scotty says, our friends within the academic community, who were able to actually disseminate the information firsthand for our guests and give them insights that normally you wouldn't have.
You wouldn't see.
And you would never hear of it. And so we were able to not use them, but bring them on board. And they were more than happy to share, because we are. They were more than happy to share their insights, their knowledge, and what they had learned about their own sites over the years.
And even here at Gebel El Silsila, how many tour groups can say they've gone through these Paleolithic sites, these pre-Bronze Age sites, and have an archaeologist say, now you can't take a picture of this because it's undocumented, we haven't published it, but look at this inscription. This is 8,000 years old. And this proves that there were boats being used here, or this or that, or whatever it might be. And you don't get that anywhere else. And that's what makes this trip interesting. And we also have to say that it is also a trip for people who, how would you say this? It's probably good to be somebody who is not, does not have any problem walking for miles through the desert, climbing a mountain. Now, we're not talking, you know, picks and axes and ropes. We're talking climbing to the top of a plateau in the Sinai. It's taxing physically, but we had some people on this trip that were in their late 60s.
Yes.
That were worried about some of that, but they did it.
They did indeed.
They climbed up inside the king's chamber in the pyramid, which is pretty standard fare, but then they were out in the Sinai desert. And there was a little complaining by some of the older folks, a couple of them that we had. And I said, but look at the bright side. You can go home and tell all your cronies, I climbed a mountain in the Sinai. And that's what's been fascinating about this trip. And we're doing it all again. There's going to be new twists to the next trip. Same basic trip as this one. But there's new twists to it, new things. We learned some things on this trip, but things will cut off and things will add. Surprises everywhere. There's tombs that you can't get into that our trip can get into because of the people we know. So October 13th through the 25th, if people want to join us, go to exodusreality.com and you can see all about it.
And hurry up.
And hurry up. Put fast if you want to join us.
All right. And you guys, do you both have your own websites?
Yes. Well, the easiest way to find either John or I in relation to what we're talking about here is either exodusreality.com. You can go to our Facebook pages. You can find us on Facebook, Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Easy to find. We do have a Facebook page. It's just facebook.com/ExodusRealityAdventures. And you can see all about what we do. And that's just become the mother site for everything we do. It's got the name of the tour group, but it's all about our book. It's all about all the different things we do.
Best thing nowadays is Facebook. It's the easiest portal for communication.
It is.
Other than telepathy.
Yes, and levitation.
And levitation.
All right. Well, I thank both of you for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Soraya.
Thanks for having us, Soraya.
It's been a blast, as usual.
And your day is just getting started, isn't it?
We are. I'm about to crack the whip and kick Scotty's ass across Gebel El Sassila.
Yes.
All right. Well, everyone can check out your website. And again, thank you very much. And we'll
thank you, Soraya. Thank you very much.
For those listening live, The Last Exit for the Lost is up next. We're taking you out with some Psyche Corporation.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection? 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Can you hear the ball? It's time to be wary. You are getting to the heart of the universe. Ventricles and Tatria, chambers numbered 1597. And counting. And counting. Can you hear?